Shelley, for the purposes of the tape, could you sort of introduce yourself and the organization? I mean, just your name and the organization's name.
Okay, yes. My name is Shelley Bendiola, and I'm the training and program campaign director for the Indigenous Environmental Network, and I also work with the Indigenous Women's Network.
Great. Okay. Let me just go to the first question, which has to do with the type of social problems on which you and your organization work. How do you define them? What is your focus within it? What are you seeking from them?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Well, the Indigenous, I'll be speaking about the Indigenous Environmental Network primarily for this for this call. And the Indigenous Environmental Network was formed by an alliance or a coalition of grassroots Native organizers throughout Canada and the lower 48 primarily. And the reason why it was formed was because there were a lot of issues that were impacting Native peoples throughout what we call Turtle Island, which is Americas, including Canada.
Right. That would be the whole continent, right?
Right. And so it's an alliance of grassroots Indigenous peoples whose mission is to protect the sacredness of Mother Earth from contamination and exploitation.
Uh-huh.
And to strengthen and maintain the traditional teachings and natural law. And we do have a way in which we conduct our work that is very spiritually based and traditionally based, and we've also included in our work the principles or and code of ethics, which include some of the teachings of the natural law. So, you know, we at the forefront of our work always, or I should say at the foundation or the basis of the work, is the teachings of respect and living in balance with Mother Earth and carrying forward the teachings of the Creator. So that's pretty much the basis from which we operate.
Mm-hmm.
And so how we define ourselves is within, you know, the scope of our mission and those guiding principles in the natural law.
And so as you formed, what particular issues did you target?
There are a myriad of different issues in Indian country. What we call our way of life or our circle of life, Western science defines as biodiversity. And it's our understanding that, you know, a large percentage of the biodiversity, say 80% of it, is under Indigenous territory. And so the issues that we work on stem from globalization, water contamination. It's basically contamination of the air, water, and land, and the exploitation of the resources that are taken from those particular land bases, and also the protection of sacred sites and our culture and traditions are key issues. That has to do primarily with our sovereignty, our inherent sovereign rights to live in a manner in which we can be self-determined and we can self-organize. So sovereignty is also a thread that goes through all of the issues that we work on.
Uh-huh. Okay. How do you go about doing your work? And what about the processes or approaches you use do you think are unique, and what do you think makes your work effective?
Okay, well, what I think is somewhat unique, although there are probably many organizations, indigenous organizations that work from this premise as well, that I may not know about, but what I do know about IEN is that we've always had, up until recently, a traditional council, which represents the over 230 communities and tribal organizations that we support and advocate for. Mm-hmm. And the traditional council come together and basically discuss what are the relevant and important issues that need to be addressed. And again, upholding the natural law and code of ethics. And within the Indigenous Environmental Network, we have developed and continue to maintain partnerships with other environmental justice networks, six of which have been operating approximately the same length of time as IEN. And IEN's been in existence for over close to 12, 13 years now. And the other six networks include the Southwest Network for Environmental and Economic Justice, the Asian Pacific Island Network, and they're, you know, I'm not going to name them all, but
okay.
What has been agreed upon through the work of these networks is this notion of we speak for ourselves. And so that is also something that we carry to promote and to educate our partners, our allies, the folks that we advocate with and for. We hold the notion of speaking for ourselves as something that is fundamental and very important in our work, so that we are not, that we can tell our own truth, that we are the people that are being impacted, we are the people that are on the front line, and so therefore we should be able to speak about the issues from that place, from within those communities that are being impacted.
Uh-huh.
And one of the lessons that we have learned over the past 10 years is that, for the most part, the mainstream environmental organizations have been organizing around issues of environmental justice. Environmental justice meaning that there's a disproportionate amount of contamination going on in communities of color and indigenous communities, that while that contamination and destruction is going on, many of the mainstream environmental organizations that are pretty much white-led,
mm-hmm,
have spoke either on our behalf or have spoken about the issues that are impacting us directly. So when we talk about the notion of speaking for ourselves as a principle that we uphold, that is where that's coming from.
Mm-hmm. So that would be a difference in the way you operate between most other environmental organizations who, while they may be concerned about environmental justice, aren't necessarily themselves, those people experiencing the impact of the degradation that they're fighting.
Right, and so, because Native people, for the most part, indigenous people are place-based people, which means,
mm-hmm,
even the term indigenous is of a place. That's what that means. And so when you're of a place, like, for example, I'm Swinomish and
mm-hmm,
Lummi and Visayan. My father was born in Hawaii. My grandparents are from the Philippines. And, my mother's enrolled Swinomish. I'm enrolled Swinomish. It's a
uh-huh,
village here in the Northwest.
Right.
In what we call Salmon Nation or Coast Salish Territory.
Mm-hmm.
And the things of this place are that give us strength, that are part of, inherent within our culture and our traditions, are things like the cedar tree. The cedar, which is very sacred to our people. The salmon, also.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the buffalo to the plains.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The salmon is our buffalo. It's what we it's part of our subsistence living. It's part of our ceremonies, our creation stories, and
mm-hmm.
so forth. So that's what I mean when I say place-based people.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you come from that experience, you can speak about that.
Mm-hmm.
If you are not of that experience, there's a whole cultural element and teaching and traditions that are left out of Western science or Western way of looking at things, which most mainstream environmentalists organizations come from that place. It's not too far, but you know, the fact of the matter is that there have been indigenous people that have been living in and maintaining that lifestyle since the beginning of time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, I just want to be very clear about
okay.
when I say that.
If you're, say there was an issue which was impacting the salmon, for example, what sorts of processes do you use to deal with the issue?
Well, as I mentioned, we do have a national traditional council that proposes issues that the organization that IEN is, which is a network, can focus on. And within the council, it is agreed upon by the Indigenous Environmental Network, the Indigenous Women's Network, Seventh Generation Fund, Honor the Earth Program, which are all very intricately connected,
mm-hmm.
so that we become aware of what these issues are, and we then strategize between the different organizations and communities ways in which we can address the specific issue. So you mentioned the salmon issue up here in the Northwest
mm-hmm.
Coast Salish territory. One of the bigger issues right now is the fish farming, and IEN is forming an alliance, and we are seeking to build a stronger partnership with the organizations that have been working on this issue for many years. One of those organizations is the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy.
Mm-hmm.
They're like a think tank, and they provide a lot of extensive research and scientific facts about the issue of industrial farm salmon
mm-hmm.
and its impact on our culture and our way of life in this particular area.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have our annual gatherings, which are now biannual gatherings. We have these annual gatherings every 2 years in
mm-hmm.
different places. Our next annual gathering will be in June of 2004 at Bear Butte, South Dakota. The issue at the theme of the conference will be protection of sacred sites. Within that gathering, we have a multitude of different issues that are presented through a plenary session, a panel of speakers from various communities or regions
mm-hmm.
that are impacted on, say, mining or nuclear waste or toxics. You know, so we have a number of different issues that are presented, and then we have a time in which we can give folks an opportunity to build alliances through networking and caucuses with folks that are being impacted in the same manner, whether it's oil extraction or the building of a pipeline, or, you know, it could be anything along the lines of what we call the chain of destruction. But the other thing that happens is we also build in skills building opportunities for training community members and affiliate organizations with the different type of direct action or organizing or coalition building skills. And so there's a number of things that are going on, but the overarching event that happens is we have our communications folks working to document the things that are shared at the gathering, and that is either recorded in audio or and video, And then, you know, we'll create an educational video, or we'll create, I forget what you call those, media spots for radio. And we also usually come up with two or three statements by the indigenous peoples who attend our Protecting Mother Earth gatherings.
Mm-hmm.
So the title of the gathering is called Protecting Mother Earth. It's our Protecting Mother Earth biannual conferences that we conduct at various sites. We have, when our national council gets together, they decide on what site. We've had an ongoing sort of request from our various communities. Like I mentioned earlier, there are over 230 communities that we advocate and support. So, you know, there are many different issues in many parts of Turtle Island. So we had our first international gathering, as a matter of fact, in Penticton, British Columbia, August 2nd through the 5th, 2001. So we are, you know, growing, and we're expanding, and we're really pleased that we were able to do that international event. Because what happens is it brings a lot of attention to the issue and the community that is being impacted.
Mm-hmm.
In 1997, we had a gathering hosted by the Gros Ventre tribe, and the White Clay Society had worked with us to coordinate and organize this gathering, and their issue was gold mining operation that was contaminating their water, and it was also destroying their sacred site, which is where they do a lot of their vision quests and gather
mm-hmm.
a lot of their traditional medicines. And as a result of our having our gathering there, the gold mining operation, Pegasus Gold Mining, shut down. So now we're faced with the cleanup because, you know, the way that the Environmental Protection Agency regulatory process has been working is quite slow, and in this particular case, the gold mining operation is not being very responsible in terms of cleaning up their mess. So that's what we're faced with now.
You mentioned, you know, in terms of skills training and stuff at the gathering. Focusing on things like direct action.
Mm-hmm.
Are those the primary... So after the council has identified an issue
mm-hmm.
and the, you know, some... And correct me if I'm wrong, but what I'm getting the picture of is then the network's role becomes... One of the roles becomes connecting the different groups that are impacted by the same issue so that they can be aware of each other's involvement in it and work together to change the situation. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's correct. That's part of our alliance building, which is it's one of the strategies
mm-hmm.
for providing support through our network. Is we have an opportunity for folks to come together, not only at our biannual gatherings to do the alliance building piece of it, but also we have many summits or gatherings. We had a mining summit, for example, in Wisconsin
uh-huh.
Last year in
uh-huh.
2002. And all of the communities that were impacted just by mining as one issue
right.
were invited to come. And
mm-hmm.
there was a lot of alliance building. There's a lot of sharing. This year we had a gathering. We're having a gathering, which is going on. It's starting next week.
Mm-hmm.
It's a two-day gathering just on oil in the Oklahoma region
mm-hmm.
because there's been a lot of impact by oil and exploration, exploitation, production.
Right.
So, so we have alliance building forums in which we set up around specific issues as well, and then we'll bring in the various community leaders who have been working at the forefront of these issues at the front line of their community, you know, for usually these people have been working for years on these issues. Some of them are new, young activists in training that are also being introduced. So we try to provide an opportunity for our youth organizers and leadership to learn these skills and learn from seasoned organizers how to develop a campaign or how to build a coalition, that kind of thing. We do have a young woman on staff. Her name is Heather Milton, a Lightning, and she is our youth organizer. And currently we're going to be running a year's worth of youth leadership training through her program.
Wow, that's exciting.
Yeah, that's very exciting.
When, okay, maybe if we could focus on a particular campaign, what one of the things that I'm trying to get a sense of in this project is the, well, let me step back from it a bit and share with you a bit of context. The conflict resolution field tends to call social conflicts like racism, for example, that are resistant to resolution. There's this term that's used for them, which is intractable conflict. And most of the work that's been done in the field on understanding conflict, on understanding intractable conflict, and how people are successful in improving the situation, focuses on conflicts in other countries, number one, and number two focuses on conflicts where there is currently large-scale physical violence. And what we're part of what we're trying to do in this project is to get a better sense of how people who work here, you know, domestically, and who work on conflicts which may not be typified by high levels of physical violence, but are real deep conflicts nonetheless. We want to broaden what's in the field and be able to talk about the sorts of strategies and techniques and processes people are using that the field doesn't even know about. So what I'm trying to get a sense of is, you know, I've gotten a sense of how you pick the issues. And let me just ask one thing about the council's work. Do they use a consensus decision-making process? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
And when that gets bogged down, they move to voting.
Ah, okay. So they have a backup.
Right.
So now they've decided that X, whatever X is an issue that is deserving of attention and that the IEN and the other organizations should be working on X, whatever X is.
Right.
And the IEN has now gone out and among, within the network, found which of the groups and communities that are part of the network are impacted by this and put them in touch with each other and even, you know, arranged a gathering space to so they can meet, you know, together in person and work out some strategies and stuff like that.
That's correct.
Once that happens, what sorts of strategies does this coalition around mining or the coalition around oil or the coalition around farm fishing, what types of things do they then decide to do to generate change on the issue?
Well, currently, I think one of our real successful campaigns is the oil campaign, and they've formed a massive network of indigenous fisher people, villages and tribes in Alaska around the oil issue. And the reasoning for that is because of the National Wildlife Refuge threat by the Bush administration to drill in the National Wildlife Refuge, which is the home of the Gwich'in people who subsist off of the porcupine caribou. Once the porcupine caribou capping grounds, which is the National Wildlife Refuge, is disturbed, the caribou begin to go away. And once the caribou go away, the entire population of Gwich'in go away.
Yeah.
So when we talk about violence on a large scale, almost every issue in Indian country, which we call Turtle Island, is a large-scale issue. Because, you know, we are a place-based people, again, in this particular area, there have been massive, massive logging of cedar trees. So our way of life disappears. So we as a people become totally assimilated. And that's not right. And so that's why our struggle to preserve our culture, language, and identity is very critical to the place in which we live. And so, you know, the connection I think that disappears or is a gray area with domestic, you know, it's putting us in these categories of what is domestic and what is not domestic.
Right.
As far as I'm concerned, I am an enrolled Swinomish member, you know, and I'm also a member of the United States. In Canada, a lot of the tribes have dual citizenship. Well, you can look at every enrolled member of a tribe, you know, in the United States as such. You know, if that were legal, a legal recognized process, which it is not.
Right.
So the fact of the matter is that you're dealing with separate native nations. I come from the Swinomish Nation because I'm enrolled in that nation.
Right.
And although I am a descendant of the Lummi and the Visayan people in the Philippines, I still, you know, I have legal membership within the Swinomish tribe, which is recognized by the United States federal government.
Yeah.
And so that is often excluded within the community of color organizing, progressive organizations, let alone the mainstream, you know.
Right.
So there's a very fundamental difference in the way we are governed upon and the way we govern ourselves. Within our own tribal entities, there are different factions, traditional versus, you know, the government, or what the way that many of our tribes have been forced to govern ourselves is by using the U.S. Constitution model, which says that we have to have a tribal governing body, and we have to have a tribal constitution, which is pretty much looks very similar to United States model.
Right.
And that doesn't often work with the traditional members of our tribes because it doesn't embrace, one, the spirituality, two, the traditions of the way we carry out the natural law.
Right.
The respect for elders, the respect for Mother Earth, that's not always included in our tribal constitution based on the United States way of doing things.
Right, and would I also be correct in saying that, you know, you may use, when you were talking about the council's work, the majority rule principle was a backup, but the primary focus was on generating consensus.
That's right.
Which you know, the U.S. Constitution doesn't say very much about consensus.
No.
So that would be, you know, another aspect that's sort of in tension with, you know, with the native way of doing things. If the government sort of, you know, the U.S. government or the Canadian government is sort of pushing a constitution that focuses on that.
Right. So we have a difference in values, basically.
Right. And when the distinction I was making, and I'm glad you clarified what you did, and I'm not when I was saying domestic, I didn't so much mean within the United States as sort of at home rather than looking outside. Mm-hmm. And what we're trying to get a handle on is the creative ways that people are approaching important conflicts that, you know, that may not have physical violence but have real violence, you know, and structural violence nonetheless, and where they're you know, people like your group are doing doesn't tend to enter the thought process of how to deal with conflict in the field of conflict resolution, because people are busy focusing on the Middle East or on some place that's over there, you know.
Yeah, rather they don't realize that there's apartheid in America still.
Exactly.
So the other thing too, when we talk about violence in our communities, we have what we call lateral oppression, and part of that lateral oppression is the high rate of alcoholism in Indian
mm-hmm.
country. So another way that we are fighting that or dealing with that particular systematic sort of form of genocide is that, you know, we have a wellness movement that is wrapped up within the structure of the way we operate as IEN. So there are no drugs or alcohol allowed at our gatherings,
uh-huh.
for example, and that,
uh-huh.
that we try to walk what we call the red road, which is not to drink. So, because we look at alcohol as a form of genocide to our people, and that was introduced to us, that wasn't
mm-hmm.
part of our culture and traditions, like, say, maybe the Italians. You don't need to quote this, but, you know.
Right.
What I'm saying, there are many, many cultures, and I'm not saying that, you know, we need to wipe out alcohol all over the world, you know, because there are many cultures that use that as a medicine, maybe, or you know, and they're ceremonies, but
right.
don't do that because it is not good for us.
Right.
Because it's been abused and it's, you know, caused a lot of violence in our community.
Right.
And I'm not talking about just, you know, domestic violence or physical violence. I'm talking about, you know, whole communities being wiped out
mm-hmm.
because they're not operating because of alcohol.
Right.
And, you know, I see in the white mainstream environmental movement, alcohol is a big way to organize. So, huge difference.
Yes.
And that goes back to the values I was talking about, different values.
Right, and I was organizing a conference in 1992, a peace conference. And the theme of it was, creating a circle, and we normally had wine at a banquet or something like that. But there were, you know, because it was focused on indigenous issues, that was, you know, that was surfaced, that issue that was, you know, that would not be appropriate in that way.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, there are many Native people, especially traditional people,
mm-hmm.
that when they're exposed to that in organizing,
mm-hmm.
that they all tend not to, you know, participate later on.
Right.
So it does have a tremendous impact on the way we organize and the way we build alliances.
Right.
If we cannot respect one another, you know, in
right.
that way, then how can we trust one another, you know, on the larger scale stuff?
Well, exactly.
So that's, so it does. I think it's a really important element of the way in which we operate.
When the so say, for example, in Alaska about the campaign about, you know, about oil among the communities in Alaska, what sorts of strategies are they using in their campaign?
Well, one of the things that we have done successfully as IEN is maintain our affiliate organizations and affiliate members who have been part of IEN since the beginning, since 1987. This was the first gathering. It was very informal. And then IEN became, you know, formally an organization in 95, and, you know, with this 501c3 status and everything, uh-huh. because there was a lot of work in the early 90s to create these bylaws and, you know, form, you know, a relationship with our fiscal sponsor as an organization. And so we have maintained these ties with leaders in the various affiliate organizations and communities for a long time. And those folks, many of, many are from Alaska region. Many are tied to the fish, the water, and the oil exploration and development that's going on up there. And so as a result of that that relationship or those relationships, we formed a good coalition of folks who are from the various villages in the Arctic area, the Arctic region, and also in the Northwest Territories, which are, you know, above Canada and mm-hmm. and northern BC area, British Columbia. And so now they're through the IEN gatherings, they have formed a even stronger network that has turned into a network of Alaska, as an alliance of Alaskan folks who are impacted by oil industry. And in addition, those particular villages and communities who also have ties locally to various mainstream groups or non-native groups pull in their relationships and expand the network even mm-hmm. more on that particular issue in that particular region. Mm-hmm. So now we have a very strong force so that when we come to a environmental forum that is, you know, either sponsored by, say, the Environmental Protection Agency and another, you know, organizing body, we can bring a delegation from the First Nation Oil Alliance. You know, that's not the name of them, but, you know, if you will, from that organizing body, a delegation to that forum and make a presentation formally, issue a statement, or even organize a press conference and pull in the media to highlight the issue around oil and what communities are being impacted and how they're being impacted and what people can do about it. So that's happening as we speak. There's a very, very strong alliance of Native and non-Native folks in Alaska who have organized around oil. Mm-hmm. And that's due to good work from our oil campaigner, Clayton Thomas Mueller, who has been traveling to Alaska quite extensively, along with those Native leaders from the various villages up there, who have mm-hmm. been working, you know, on environmental justice issues for 10, 12, 20 years, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
On a very grassroots level, all of this organizing is going on.
My guess is we're getting to the point where you have to go do what you're needing to do.
Yeah,
is that true?
A couple more minutes here.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this within the couple more minutes. Are there any things written about any of these campaigns that are, you know, like on a website someplace or online that I could read?
Yeah, it's our website is www.ienearth.org.
Okay.
And then there's many links to other websites. Like, for example, one of our long-standing affiliate organizations is the Western Shoshone Defense Project.
Mm-hmm.
Another is the Gwich'in Steering Committee and Caribou Commons. Those are other links that you'll see on our website. Mm-hmm. So we have links to, you know, our affiliate organizations, some of our affiliate organizations, and the reason why I say some is because, you know, we can't list everybody and everything, but we can list the hot spots that IAN really, you know, has been doing a lot of advocacy and support work on, and those, you know, those are the areas in which we pull people in, because those areas have been being organized around for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
So when we have a newer community that is, you know, jumping on the bandwagon and saying we need to really deal with this because our community is being approached by this oil refinery proposal.
Right.
Then we say, you need to talk to the, you know, folks up in the Arctic and, you know, about the oil exploration that they're dealing with. And we start to make the connection because many of our communities are being impacted in different ways.
Right.
In the Arctic, say, the Gwich'in, that's oil exploration. In the Fort Berthold area, they're just now, you know, maybe considering a proposal for developing an oil refinery. So then their issue is refineries. You see what I'm saying?
Right, right, yes.
That's what I meant by chain of destruction earlier, that mm-hmm. there are different ways in which communities are impacted by oil.
Right.
Some may be just, you know, having to deal with the waste cleanup of a, you know, of a mining operation or an oil operation that has abandoned its site.
Mm-hmm.
You know, others are, you know, so there's many ways in which...
Or dump the oil out and...
Yeah.
And
building a pipeline through your community.
Right.
You know what I mean? So there's different ways in which communities are impacted by an issue.
Exactly.
That's just what
I'm thinking is, what you've shared with me thus far is very rich,
mm-hmm.
and what I'd like to suggest is that I read the, you know, some of the material on the website.
All right.
And maybe set up a time to talk to you again next week in case I have some follow-up things from some of that.
Okay.
You know, would that be okay?
Yeah, that'd be fine.
Is there a time next week that'll work for you?
Next week, I'll be here on Monday.
Uh-huh.
So, and let's see what's happening on Tuesday. I fly to Austin and then to Oklahoma, so probably Monday would work best.
Okay.
At the same time.
Okay. Yes, I can take some time at this time on Monday. That would be good.
Okay.
Okay. Well, Shelley, I really appreciate your flexibility and
sure.
your responsiveness, and I enjoy listening to you, too.
Thank you. I just want to encourage you, if I'm not at this phone number,
right?
It's the best one because it's a landline, but try my cell phone number.
Okay. They placed the call, so I'll give them that as a backup.
Yeah, because that way then I know for sure I won't miss you.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Have a good weekend.
Okay, you too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, here's what I was going to do and see if this makes sense to you. There were a few questions on the interview list that we didn't get to last time, and I was going to quickly ask you those and just see if you had anything that you wanted to fill in there. And then I was going to ask you a couple of things about the stuff I learned on the website.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be okay?
Yeah.
Okay. And if you don't think these questions relate to what you do, you can either say, you know, I don't have a helpful answer to that, or you can rearrange the question to answer it, okay?
Okay.
Okay. Have you had any successes or achievements that you're particularly proud of? And if so, could you tell me a little bit about one or more of them?
Well, we did manage to shut down Pegasus gold mining operation, and I think I mentioned this on our last call.
Which corporation? I'm sorry,
gold mining operation?
The gold mining operation?
In 1997, we had a IEN Protecting Mother Earth gathering at the Gros Ventre Reservation in Montana.
Right.
and it, and as a result of the attention that that brought and the exposure, Pegasus gold mining operation shut down, and now, you know, it's just a matter of making them accountable for cleaning up their mess.
Okay. Yeah, and you did tell me a little bit about that one. You're right. Are there any articles or, you know, like there's so much on your website. I was sort of overwhelmed by it. Is there anything on there in particular that I should look to get more information on that?
I don't know if there's anything published on that, actually.
Okay.
I have no idea.
Okay. All right. Were there any failures that you've had that caused you to change something about the way you do your work?
One of the things that we discovered is having too many people in a decision-making, well, I shouldn't say decision-making, I should say more of a formal, structured, non-profit leadership.
Mm-hmm.
That we had a 14-member national council and it was very difficult to come to agreements.
Mm-hmm.
So having maybe a smaller body that oversees the legal functioning and infrastructure of the organization is better, and having a traditional national council for issues, questions, you know, functioning in the form more of an advisory,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to a board that has, you know, responsibilities for fundraising and
mm-hmm.
directing the organization in that way. So
okay.
That's one of the lessons we learned. Having too many people in that role can bog down the process of moving any kind of planning or even creating a strategic plan.
Okay. Let me go to the stuff on your internet site and ask you a couple of questions about how you operate and what you do that's built on that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So if I go into the general pages and the home page, and then I get to, I click something and I get to the Indigenous Mining Campaign Project, am I correct in the way I read that it's a project of IEN, is that right?
What is the project of IEN?
Indigenous Mining Campaign Project?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And is it like on the now I'm in the wrong place. I thought I was on a different page. Wait a minute. Let me make sure I'm on the right page here. Okay. Now, on the first page of Indigenous Mining Campaign Project, it lists services as information clearinghouse, coalition building, community outreach, referrals and resources, and hosting meetings and conferences. Is that representative of the types of services you would provide for any project? That any project would try to include those services to the constituency?
Not necessarily. It depends on the project. We have a youth project, for example, that is providing, one of the initiatives is just to provide training.
Okay.
But for the issue areas, that sounds pretty accurate.
Okay. So
some of our programs do and some of our programs don't. There's like, we have two programs, the Capacity Building Training Initiative and the Youth Program.
Mm-hmm.
And then the others are campaign areas. So for most campaign areas, that would be true. There's a difference between programs and campaigns.
Okay. Could you describe the difference a little bit between programs and campaigns?
Programs are more when we offer technical assistance and specific to maybe a few communities, maybe one community, specific to a group, like in this case, youth.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas issues overlap, you know, all sectors.
Okay. Okay.
And issues more has to do with a specific environmental or land, air, water type of issue. Whereas programs is more, I guess, the issue is more on the problem.
Uh-huh.
That's impacting the community, and the programs are more about design, you know, a process for dealing with those type of issues, but also capacity building.
Okay.
Within the organization and within the campaign areas.
Okay.
Area, and then in parentheses, S.
Okay, I can picture it. I wanted to check something out that's sort of a combination of my reading some of the stuff on the site and my understanding from our conversation last week. My impression was that the particular strategies on a given campaign, let me check one thing out first, that a given campaign like mining might have several different coalitions within it depending on the particular, you know, as the issue gets subdivided. Is that true? Okay. Like there's the mining project, okay? And you were stressing last week that the strategies developed are specific to each issue. And I was thinking that maybe a general campaign like mining, would that have different issues in it? Like, for example, would pit mining be that there might be a specific coalition developed around pit mining that was specific to that, rather than, I don't know a lot about mining, so I don't know what all the different categories might be. Or is there just one coalition for the mining campaign?
I think there's a lot of different coalitions on
okay.
the campaign.
Okay.
Because there's so many environmental organizations out there.
Right. So,
in the fish farm industry issue, there's an alliance of First Nation folks, and then there's a coalition of First Nation folks, but both function in the same manner.
Uh-huh. Okay. And as that, also one of the things I saw on the net was, you know, a lot of stuff about political strategies in terms of contact, you know, an alert to contact a senator or something like that, and a lot of focus on changing laws.
Mm-hmm.
With it, you know, as different strategies within a given campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other types of strategies that I didn't pick up on? As you know, is there treaty renegotiation? Is there? I didn't see stuff on that, but you know, I can't even pretend to have gone completely through the. Numerous articles on the website.
I'm not sure exactly what you're asking me.
Oh, okay. Well, let me step back from it a bit. If I'm, when I myself talk about strategies, like changing a law might be one strategy, putting pressure on elected representatives might be a strategy. Actually, that might be a sub-strategy of changing a law. there might be other strategies involving negotiating between a corporation and a group of residents, or there might be emphasis on renegotiating a treaty. And what I'm trying to get a sense of is that although I know that the coalitions, rather than you yourself or your office, determine the strategies, I'm just trying to get a sense of the range of strategies that are used. And the ones I noted as I went through was, had to do with a lot of it focused on enacting new laws, changing existing laws, either through putting pressure on legislators or through publicizing the issues.
I'm lost here. What is
okay.
the question?
Okay. Let me see. My question is, are there other goals that are sought by the different coalitions than legal or political ones?
Yes.
Okay. What would those be?
Building alliances, building relationships, stuff like that.
Okay.
Organizing, without the feds and the agencies involved.
Okay.
Strategic planning sessions, coming to the table first and figuring out what the issues are and how they're going to even start to begin to strategize. I don't know, pre-strategy meeting?
Uh-huh.
I don't know what you
okay.
call it. To me, it's alliance building.
Do you use processes like negotiation and mediation and stuff like that in terms of coming to the table? Or when you're at the table, I should say?
Usually when there's experts around that can do that, but I've gone to many mainstream environmental meetings where that's not happening.
Yeah.
But when I go to the IAN gatherings or work with Native people, I see a lot more of that because some of that kind of modern negotiation, mediation, is really based on a real old traditional way of doing things that we're familiar with as Native people.
Uh-huh.
So, respect, listening, those are English words for things that we've been doing, we've been taught, how we were raised.
Right.
Big difference.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, all of the mainstream meetings that I've gone to by mainstream environmental organizations,
mm-hmm.
99% of them, as well as the agency meetings,
mm-hmm.
they're pretty sterile and Robert's Rules of Order and, let's interrupt each other and whoever can talk the loudest can get their issues heard kind of thing.
Right.
I'm not really, I tend not to shy away from those kind of meetings as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what I'm going to do at this point, I think, is try to do some writing up of the different responses that we've gotten.
Okay.
And what I want to do is, when it's still in, sort of draft form,
uh-huh.
if I could email you. It won't be just about it. We've interviewed somewhere between 7 and 10 different different groups for this part of the project.
Yeah.
And so it would include some stuff from all of those different interviews. But what I want to do is send out the draft to all of the people that we've interviewed so that they can look at it and you can look at it and say, wait a minute, you misunderstood something I was saying, or now that I see what you're getting at here, I wish you had been clearer about this, but this is something I'd like to add, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want to make sure that it is as reflective as possible of the different types of ways in which people are going about doing this sort of work. And the just to let you know, the other most of the groups we've talked to deal with either identity or racial issues, different aspects of racism. Probably, as far as I can think off the top of my head, yours is a group that deals with a set of issues that relate to, you know, what I would classify as racial and identity conflict, you know, but you focus in on the environment. And there's one group that's focusing in on transportation issues within, you know, a largely African-American community.
Mm-hmm.
So they're, the groups are different, but they are, you know, are dealing in some way with, we may have one that deals with sexual identity issues, but I think most of them deal with race or culture or nationhood differences.
Okay.
Okay?
Great.
And so I will email that to you hopefully a little bit later this week so that you can look at the draft, and if I've missed anything, misrepresented something, or there's something you want to add, just let me know, because I'm not trying to put words in anybody's mouth.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay?
That sounds good.
Okay, great. And thanks so much for being available, Shelley, and
sure.
I'll look forward to whatever comments you have about what I write up.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks
a lot. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.